All right, good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the meeting of the Finance and Capital Committee. Since we will be discussing issues related to the 2020 fiscal year budget, I'm pleased to welcome our other board members to this meeting, though I would like to remind members who aren't on the committee that they are not able to vote at this meeting. I would like to ask for the committee's approval of the agenda. If there are no objections, we'll consider the agenda approved. Any objections? Thank you. Seeing none, we'll move the agenda. The agenda is approved. So, can I get a committee member's approval of the minutes from our two meetings on September 13th, the committee meeting and our executive session? Second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor? Thank you. All right. So, sorry? Need a vote? All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Opposed? Okay. The ayes have it. All right. So before we begin our presentations, I'd like to briefly review the items before us this morning. Our agenda item is to update Metro's, our first agenda item is to update Metro's use regulations, which govern the permitted use of Metro property by others and seeks additional authority to see food and drink on Metro property outside of paid areas and to delegate the general manager the authority to approve such commercial uses on Metro property. Next, we'll have a preview of Metro's fiscal year 2020 operating budget and the 2020 to 2025 capital improvement program known as the CIP. While the GM will introduce his proposed 2020 fiscal year budget next month, today's presentation will give an overview of the considerations and priorities that are being used in the development of the budget and the capital improvement program. With that, I will turn it over to Ms. Nina Albert to begin our presentations. Nina.
Thank you so much, Committee Chairman. This morning we will be presenting the proposed updates to WMATA's use regulations. There are three board items before you. One is to accept and approve the revised and restated use regulations. Two is we are seeking authority from the board to authorize the sale of food and drink on Metro property outside of the Metro Rail station's paid area. And then third, we're seeking a delegation from the board to the general manager and CEO the authority to approve commercial uses on Metro property. Generally speaking, the use regulations are WMATA's way of not only governing and running how we use excess property or property that we own, but it also communicates with others what we're permitted to use Metro property for. So it does regulate the use of our property for use by a third party. It's very clearly stated in our use regulations consistently through time that the primary purpose for Metro property is for transit operations. So any third-party use would be subservient to Metro's own needs to run the transit system. Again, some of the other primary purposes of the use regulations are to ensure the safety of the riding public as well as Metro's own employees, to make sure that the property itself is being used safely. And it provides guidance on what activities that can generate revenue for Metro are permitted and providing sort of a template and a set of standards for the issuance of permits. It does not include when Metro has to take on contracts or agreements with other transit users. That falls outside of the use regulations. Joint development and utility activity is also not covered in this use regulation. Just general background, the first publication of the use regulations was as early as 1987, and subsequently there have been a number of board authorizations to allow third-party uses. Some of those include permitting communications antennas and equipment, as well as fiber optic cables. Just to let you know, the leases from fiber optic and communications antenna leases, or the revenue generated, is close to about $15 million a year for Metro. So this is a significant opportunity that Metro identified as early as 1995. What's also permitted are non-transit uses of our parking facilities, civic uses, et cetera. Commercial uses have been permitted since 2004, and that includes things such as vendors and other kinds of retailers. But historically, since 2004, has always excluded the permission to sell food and beverage, as well as tobacco. And so just recently in 2017, the board approved the sale of food and beverage on our parking facilities, and then limited to weekends and holidays. So I'd like to share a little bit more of why we're seeking to expand some of that authority. So here's what's currently permitted on Metro property. It's quite broad: filming and photography, advertising. There's quite an extensive discussion about what assets Metro can offer advertising on, vending of newspapers, temporary uses, ATMs. I mentioned communications equipment. Commercial uses are authorized, public and community uses, public telephone services, which currently today is not really a thing. It's obsolete. So all of these are what are currently permitted inside of our 2008 use regulations. So really, just by the fact that 10 years have passed, we would like to update the use regulations to reflect what our current practices are, what our current permitting process is, to make sure that we're referencing other Metro programs that are offered, such as art and transit. Our bike program, you know, relationship with Capital Bike Share and M-Bike and others. Right now, just because the use regulations are as old as they are, they don't reflect what we're currently doing, and we want to integrate some of that work into the use reg so it's clear for anybody who's seeking a permit from us. There have been board approvals that have been made since 2008. We want to update the use regs to reflect those. And then to the extent that the board will approve the authorizations that we're seeking today, we would want to integrate that into our use regulations as well. So on to the two new authorizations that we're seeking, the sale of food and drink outside of the paid areas. Currently, food and drink is approved on parking facilities on weekends and holidays. However, and New Carrollton is actually the most recent example of a request that we've received by our joint development partner to set up a farmers market. And because it's sort of an emerging market, the best time to have a farmers market is during the weekday when the tenants of the new office building are going to access and want to shop, as opposed to on the weekend where at this particular station where people are frankly not frequenting that often. So the restriction to weekends and holidays doesn't serve our best purpose here. So we would like a little bit more flexibility to have the sale of food and beverage on Metro property all week long. And then the other thing, too, is that the limitation to having the sale of food and drink on parking lots only, again, is overly restrictive. And I cite, again, New Carrollton. I've indicated in this image two areas where we've worked with the joint development partner on where would be a logical place to have either a farmer's market or, you know, other kinds of food services. And there's a plaza. It's not on the parking lot. It's actually a public area and more of a park, which is close to the Amtrak station entrance, would actually be an ideal location. It would not interrupt or impact the parking facilities, but it's tucked away and is actually a perfect location for a farmer's market. So I think that what the board has historically wanted to control with regard to food and drink was making sure that people did not feel that there was authorization to eat and drink on the Metro while they're riding. So we're not seeking to lift any of those restrictions, and that's why we're stipulating the authorization of food and drink outside of the paid area, move it to the exterior of the station, which I think is really what the intent of the of all of us has always been, to really generate that activity, start to promote retail uses, but outside of the station area. The second authorization that we're seeking is delegation to the general manager and CEO approval of commercial uses. Currently, the authorization that the board has provided is that commercial uses are authorized subject to final board approval. So that's one thing. The second is that the board has already approved specifically for parking areas that the general manager has delegated authority to approve commercial uses on our parking facilities. But again, not on those specific locations that fall outside of the parking facilities. We have had a variety of commercial interests approach us saying that they would like to have, for example, certain types of non-food vending machines. There's, you know, a variety of, and they're, you know, large and small vendors. The general manager, in order to be able to just manage this process more effectively, rather than coming back to the board every time an individual user, whether they have a temporary use or more permanent use, coming back to the board every single time just becomes challenging to manage and introduces into the marketplace just more delay in order to get their permit. All of our commercial uses on Metro property are subject to local regulations, and so the controls around what is built and on Metro property still needs to comply with local regulatory rules and regulations. So I think that there's multiple checks and balances on what the general manager approves, and that's why we think that it's appropriate for the board to delegate to the general manager approval of commercial uses. So lastly, we would recommend the board approval of the revised and restated use regulations, the authorization for the sale of food and beverage on Metro property outside of the station's paid areas, and then lastly, delegation to the general manager, the authority to approve commercial uses. With that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you, Nina. All right, so we've had the presentation. May I have a motion now to consider this before comment from one of the committee members? Mr. Goldman moved it, second.
Second.
Okay, questions and comments? Mr. Goldman.
Nina, I fully support these efforts to increase retail opportunities in Metro, both inside the platform as well as on outside in the parking areas. In fact, there was a pilot program that I'm aware of at Grosvenor, in which the developer there set up some retail sites outside of the paywall, where we used cut-up 1,000 series rail cars and some little retail establishments in there. Has there been some analysis of how that experiment went and what kind of retail establishments were there and which were successful and which weren't?
Yeah, the joint development partner at Grosvenor wanted to do biannually, once in the spring and once in the fall, a pop-up. They created five or six different stations. They had a bakery, a florist, a company that sells gifts like hats and scarves and things like that, and then some food vendors, a small company that sells juices and et cetera. And then what they also did is activated it with live music. They chose to pop up the retail in the afternoon. So as people were leaving the Metro station on their commute home, they were providing services. The rest of the time, there was no retail available. They had difficulty initially identifying retailers, particularly small vendors, that could take time away from their full-time operation to come and staff the pop-up. But ultimately, they ended up, and some of the feedback that we got from vendors was extremely positive, and it was really more on the branding and marketing side. So the florist, for example, that doesn't have a commercial storefront, they really do more delivery, got brand awareness, and they also got the vending opportunity. And so there was a combination of being able to provide real services. Galley Foods was there also, which is take-home prepared food service. So they didn't quite see the uptick that they were hoping to see, but I think that that's because folks were not as aware of Galley Foods, so the brand awareness was important. And then the reception that, so when polled, all of those vendors said that they would want to return back. So as we're looking at a fall season, we're trying to get that up and going again. So very positive from the vendor side, very positive from the consumer side. And I think people enjoyed also just the music. It just caused people to take a few minutes out of their day to stop, listen, and maybe circulate around the retail area. And I think our consumer, the transumers, the transit customer, really enjoyed getting to know some more local vendors. What we want to do as we're, the Grosvenor is a perfect example, that opportunity and the timeline that the that the joint development partner was under, spring and fall, having the delegation to the general manager to just go ahead and get that going was something that was really important. And so we got authorization for that activity from the board, but I think that you can see that there is just an inherent synergy and responsibility that the staff feels towards creating an environment that's positive as opposed to one that might be negative. But generally, those are very successful pilots.
Would it be possible for you to put out a little after-action report
Sure.
for the board members and also just distribute it to media so that others, developers and other potential retail users can see what works, at least in the Grosvenor context?
Absolutely.
I want to ask you a question on your slide that's headed at the top, delegation to general manager, approval of commercial uses. And this slide seems to talk about parking lots and it seems to talk about vending machines. I guess my question is, if someone wants to open a newsstand on a platform or a flower shop on the platform, is that currently authorized by the use regulations?
Well, it's currently authorized under the use regulations generally. But previously, without this authorization, the board would then need to approve that. And so,
the general manager
would have the authority under this proposal to authorize that.
So this delegation is broad enough that if someone wants to open a flower shop, a gallery place, or someone wants to open a newsstand, Grosvenor on the platform, all he has to do is come to you and ultimately get an approval from the general manager.
That's correct.
There's nothing you have to bring back to the board.
That's right.
Yeah, I just want to make sure.
Mike, if I could clarify, when you're saying on the platform, are you still referring to outside the gates?
I'm talking both ways, either beyond, within the paywall or outside the paywall of the fair gate so that, you know, someone, for example, in Gallery Place, there's a lot of space after you go through the paywall.
Right, but are we talking inside and outside? Because I thought this was about outside the gates.
So outside the gates relates to the sale of food and drink. So that would be limited to outside the gates. We are for the commercial uses are permitted inside the gates as well, provided that it's not food and drink. So Mr. Goldman mentioned newspapers or a florist. That's not food and drink. So yes, in theory, that could be inside the gates. And it's also correct that there are a variety of platforms that have quite a bit of unused space. And so we would not, you know, want to crowd the platform so that it posed any sort of safety hazard or congestion, particularly on platforms that just, you know, have a lot of activity going on. But there are areas within our metro stations that have that are vacant, frankly, and could provide service to consumers.
Okay. So I just want to make sure we don't need to have any kind of further amendment to authorize retail sales on both sides, not just vending machines, but actual person. Either selling newspapers or flowers or, you know, having a cleaning cleaner shop, something like that.
Yeah, so that could be authorized inside the paid area.
But once we vote on this as a committee, And then as a full board, that will be authorized, subject to approval of the general manager.
That's
is that correct?
Good.
Okay, thank you. That clears
it. Yeah, I would submit for your consideration that you should look at Columbus Circle in New York. Given our population of riders, young people, and so forth, that's a marvelous arrangement there, the grab-and-go activities, flower shops, eateries, and so forth. And I think that we're behind the curve on this, and we talk about ridership and other things of that nature. I think, you know, we need to really kind of begin to start embracing those things. And the second item, I'm somewhat appalled that we've limited the CEO from doing these things. This is kind of nonsensical for as far as I'm concerned. You know, having to approve these things should be in the bailiwick of the CEO, but we'll do what we have to do to go ahead and move this on. But I strongly suggest that the grab-and-go arrangements and things of that nature, they're marvelous. A lot of young people congregate down there in terms of on their way home and, you know, grabbing, you know, food and beverages and flowers and things of that nature. So I think it'll be a real boom for us in certain stations that can accommodate it from a space point of view.
Thank you, Corbett. Steve.
Yes, I'm mostly reinforcing what others have said here. The correct form of the rules would have a bright line of a very few things that are not allowed, and the ability for management working with local jurisdictions to approve things that make sense. And we can't assume that we can anticipate what all those things are. Corbett did mention some good potential opportunities, things we're seeing in other places, but somebody's got a bright idea out there that we don't know about, and we need to communicate clearly that we're receptive to those bright ideas, and if it makes sense for us as much as it does for them, that we could see that happening at a metro station, so that's a good thing. On the sort of, you know, presentation and follow-up, I also want to echo what Mr. Goldman was saying. You mentioned on one of the slides the revenue that's being generated through the communications facilities. I think when we go to the full board, the more numbers we can see, the better job we can do satisfying ourselves and the public that what feels the right thing to do here is in fact the right thing to do. You know, not just go forward on a belief, but proof and experience that good things are out there. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Steve. Nina, from my perspective, with the change in the regulations, how do we assure that local jurisdictions' permitting requirements are being fulfilled? So if the general manager approves a permit, whether it's a flower shop, a dry cleaner, or a vending machine, how do we assure that the we are not superseding local jurisdiction regulations or laws?
I'll go ahead and ask our general counsel to answer that. But generally speaking, our compact requires that anything that WMATA does complies with local law. And so the compact requires it. Everything that we do has to abide by that. Otherwise, we're in default of that. But I'll let her share further.
Okay.
Good morning. Yes, so the compact, Section 75, does require that the authority comply with laws, ordinances, and regulations of the three signatories. And there's nothing that we could put in the use regulations, whether we put it in or keep it out, that would supersede what we're required to do. If the laws are applicable, we have to comply with it.
Okay. So while the general manager may allow them to use the space, nothing happens unless they have met local jurisdictional needs or requirements.
To the extent it's applicable. If there's a law that's applicable to a certain vendor, whatever that vendor happens to be selling, then we would need to comply with it. If the law is not applicable, then his authority or his approval would be sufficient.
Okay. So within the use regulations, should we refer them to Section 75 of the compact that says, this permit does not give you the authority to do business. It allows you, if you, whatever that
correct language is.
All due respect, I think that's overreaching. I don't think it's necessary to do that, but the general counsel can speak to that.
Again, it's not necessary because there's nothing we can do that would trump our requirement to comply with the compact. The compact has been codified in all three jurisdictions, so it's actually also the law in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, as well as being an interstate compact with the consent of Congress. And so there's nothing we could do that would enable us to not comply with an applicable law. However, if there's, you know what I mean, if the jurisdiction wants, I can cite to it. I'm happy to put a cite to it, which doesn't change anything. It's just citing.
Yeah, I think that's what I'd be comfortable with if we just cited them to that requirement within the compact, not changing it.
Steve?
Is
what you're getting at, Jim, who's got the burden of ensuring compliance? Or, you know, do we as the landlords
I think the permittee.
It's the permittee, yeah.
Has to fulfill those local requirements.
And if they fail to do so, then they're in breach of their agreement with us.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Comments or questions from non-committee members? Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm supportive of this, and I'm going to ask a few due diligence questions. So one, when looking at the efficiency of delegating this and not having the board have some way of either providing prior approval or an after approval look back, did you look at other communities or did we just think at what would work well for WMATA? Is this sort of standard practice elsewhere where these uses are allowed, or did we not do that kind of research?
You mean for other transit
other transit properties
and how they operate?
Well,
most other transit authorities are permitted to sell food and drink throughout, you know, even inside the system. And many other transit authorities, but it's all over the board, candidly, in terms of the space that they have and how they run their permitting. But on one extreme is, you know, New York Transit System that, you know, has tremendous amount of retail, both inside the station, outside the station, on platforms. So there wasn't necessarily an exact comparable, but I think that the delegation to the general manager to manage the stations is provided, but I cannot say with certainty whether or not every transaction goes back to the board.
Okay, so you think it's standard practice, but you're not sure. Okay.
If I may, just from the airport experience, that is the standard practice, you know, that basically
at airports.
The CEO, they get the approval to do it, similar to this,
right?
But then they're responsible for managing it, meeting all the requirements, you know, whatever the regulations are out there, but not going back and asking the Board of Public Works for approval for every time there's another addition at the airports.
I think it'd just be helpful to know where we will stand with this action compared to other transit properties generally, just to know where we are. I do have a couple of questions that are just a little unclear to me from the scope, and these are sort of in the what-if category. And, you know, one question coming from your slide at New Carrollton as to where you would potentially locate something. And this could be farmers markets, it could be food trucks. So the question comes into, you know, there's the level of we have to comply with all laws, but that doesn't necessarily include all policies of a jurisdiction. There are things that are short of law, policy, directives, objectives. So, for example, if in and around this area there were a significant number of small business food establishments, for example, would there be a way for this jurisdiction to weigh in on whether or not it would be defeating to their economic development objectives to have food trucks compete with those small businesses on that site, for example?
Right. So clearly food trucks are sort of an emerging market, and each jurisdiction is responding to it in kind and wrestling with how to regulate, whether to regulate that type of activity. So at this moment, if a food truck is not permitted in a particular jurisdiction, then a food truck would not be permitted on metro property. To the extent that that's something that a jurisdiction is wrestling with and hasn't come up with a regulation, I think the way to handle that is through a communication and make sure that we understand what the local jurisdiction's requirements are. we have had specifically in Prince George's County, actually in Montgomery County as well, but primarily in Prince George's County, multiple requests that food truck by the county to have food trucks on our property because it's a way to boost up a market that doesn't have a retail presence yet, so a temporary market. We have not had those same requests from, frankly, any of the jurisdictions in Virginia. And so I think that a communication allows us to understand what the local policies are. We have not been tremendous. Metro has not been as active as it could be in having third-party and commercial uses. So I think that in these early stages, as we start to ramp up this program, having close communication is important so that everybody starts to become educated on what could be and what should be at these properties.
That's a terrific answer, one that I wanted to hear, but it's not really captured in the use regulations, and that's not a criticism. It's not really possible to necessarily do it well. But I would encourage you to think about ways in which we further flesh out how we think that communication is going to occur to account for these and other unforeseen circumstances where it's not simply a matter of jurisdiction law that precludes something, but may not be compatible necessarily with where a jurisdiction is heading in other areas. And we don't really have a clear path forward for how that communication would take place because it wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense for WMATA to go ahead and license its facilities for food trucks, for example, while a jurisdiction is deciding that it's going to limit food trucks in that particular area only to then have the contractual issue with your licensee later on that it has to be removed. That's something that wouldn't reflect well on anyone. So,
well, I think that there are our current permits, real estate permits, as well as future permits, basically the same permit form. Every single permit that we issue is subject to WMATA's rights to terminate. And that is captured in the use regulations. And actually, frankly, it's clearer in this current version and proposed version of the use regulations than the former. Okay. So even if WMATA were to inadvertently get sideways with what the local jurisdiction's policies were, the local jurisdiction could approach WMATA, and that permittee is subject to determination. So I think that there's kind of the communication and proactive approach, but then there's also the other, which is that if it becomes known post-permit, a way to remedy that.
And we've addressed commercial uses a lot in all of this, and I'm thinking more of sort of civic or quasi-governmental uses. So, for example, what would have to happen if, you know, let's say a jurisdiction wanted to promote tourism opportunities in and around a particular metro station? Is that possible? It seems like it's possible.
It's already actually fully authorized.
Right.
So that the only limitation, and the majority of requests that we've gotten from the jurisdictions tend to be around farmers markets. And the restriction on the sale of food and drink was always what was prohibiting us from actually putting in place a farmers market program. But right now there would be no restrictions, and there haven't been for some time, if a jurisdiction wanted to do a pop-up event or, you know, something that would really be an economic development or some sort of marketing event. We could do that now.
And how would we treat it? What's the current thinking of management? Is that something that you would seek to fit into this, let's monetize this from a let's make this a revenue stream opportunity, or is this something that we would view as a collaborative partnership with the jurisdiction?
So it would depend on what it is, but the entire gamut of that is available. So I'll give an example of Capitol Heights. The town of Capitol Heights every year has a festival that they do for their community. It's called Community Day. And for the past, I don't want to state, but it's at least been 5 years, we've been issuing a permit at no cost to the local jurisdiction to have their Community Day. So typically we want to encourage activity around the metro station. The opportunity for revenue generation is not supposed to be punitive or at a deterrence for community activity, civic activity. What we want to do is get a more streamlined process going so that we can have more of these activities, whether they are commercial or civic, on our property.
I think it might be, we could say that it's actually improving the customer experience as much as it is improving the revenue stream to Metro in some cases.
It like could the, be yeah. with current management's thinking, but you know, remember the delegation is broad.
Correct.
So.
All right. And other comments? Okay. So we've had a motion and a second. On the discussion, we're going to make a reference to bullet number 75 within the compact for following local jurisdictional requirements. So with that change to what we're submitting here, can I have a vote on accepting this with those comments? So all in favor of forwarding this to the board, say aye. All those opposed? Abstentions? Okay, thank you. The ayes have it. So we will move this forward to the board. All right, so So now we want to talk about the priorities for the 2020 fiscal year operating budget and the five-year capital program. So, Dennis, I will turn it over to you and your team now.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to just kick this off, if I could.
Okay.
I just wanted to give some context first for the presentation of what we pulled together for the board. First, just recognizing that we have some new members that have been through the process. Second is this is the first budgeting year that we will obviously have the dedicated revenue sources in place, and it's also the first year that we'll have the 3% mandate in place. And then finally, what we've tried to do is start to pull together the budget for the board in the context of where the board wants to focus on, which is larger policy issues, as we go forward, and clearly they play out in the budget. So we're not looking for any decisions today, and the details will come as we go through the process over the next few months, but I thought it was important for us just to step back and put things sort of in a little bit larger perspective so we're all on the same page going forward. So I wanted just to bring everyone's attention to sort of an update on the Keep Metro Safe, Reliable, and Affordable plan that we put out in April 17. If you may recall, at that time, we put out 10 recommendations, 5 related to the capital program and 5 related to the operating budget and operating program. So I just want to give an update on where we are with those. So on the average annual capital investment ran up to $1.5 billion. We are doing that, and it was driven, obviously, by the recommendation for the dedicated capital trust fund. We have limited that only to capital to projects and will not be using that for operating any operation cost, as, again, was one of the recommendations. And we are limiting the jurisdiction's annual capital contribution on the base to 3%. So those things have all been achieved. The one, unfortunately, that has not been achieved is the reauthorization of PREA. And I have to stress this is the most important one in front of us because it impacts us in the second quarter of fiscal year 20, in our fiscal year 20, because PREA goes away at the end of September of that year. And so that is a huge issue for us and to the tune of $300 million per year into the future. So that one has not been addressed. I mean, it has been, obviously, a lot of action has occurred around it, but it's not been achieved. On the operating side, and the focus there was to move towards a ongoing and long-term sustainable operating model. The limitation on the operating subsidy growth of 3% is a mandate both in Virginia and Maryland, and also was a policy that we implemented in the 19 budget. And then we have achieved innovative competition contracting, both in the Cinderbed project, the new bus facility there, and we've just recently put out on the street for the Silver Line Phase 2. So we're continuing in that vein. Things that have not been achieved that we raised at that time in April 17 was amending the National Capital Area Interest Arbitration Standard Act, what's locally known as the WOAF Act, to basically give a little bit stronger parameters when we go into bond arbitration what those would be. The other was the restructuring of the retirement benefits for new employees. What we had proposed was looking at a defined contribution program for new employees only. And then also creating a rainy day fund, again, just given the scale of this operation, to have no resources to go to except to go back to the local jurisdictions when we get pressure to deliver for all kinds of reasons that events occur in the region. So I just wanted to lay that out because that was, you know, a year and a half ago, and we have moved in quite a bit of areas there, but there are still things to be addressed both in the short term and long term that impact the 20 budget and impact budgets into the future. So the I have identified a number of priorities for the 20 budget. On the capital program first, we need to make sure that as we look at our capital expenditures, we're looking at the customer experience with those and to make sure that we're always thinking in, from a customer perspective first, everything from even how we design it, how we schedule it, and how we deliver it. We are fully committed to funding safety and compliance. That is, you know, that is not up for debate, I don't think, anywhere. And so we will continue that process and that sort of priority. We'll continue to focus on system preservation and state of good repair, again, so that we can continue the progress that's been made and not slip back to where we were. We are putting quite a bit of focus on meeting the program budget and schedule. And as you know, last year we delivered 99% of the capital budget, and we will continue to make sure that everyone within the agency understands the importance of that. And we're also putting in the mechanisms. We need to put in mechanisms to ramp up to the $1.5 billion capital program. A lot of that's going to be done with outside resources, so we'll continue to do that. And then, as you know, we have created a capital investment pipeline, what we call the D&E program, the Development Evaluation Program. And really, that is to better understand the scope, budget, and schedule of projects before we commit. And so we want to continue that process and build on that. And that's also where we start to bring in new projects that people have talked about. On the operating side, the priorities, again, we have to look at the, particularly the subsidy issue, as it's not just a cost issue, it's also a revenue issue. So we want to look at means of increasing ridership. We obviously have to continue to maximize operational efficiencies and save dollars wherever we can. We want to look at increasing non-fare revenues, and this discussion we just had on the other agenda item is a perfect example of that. And then also, we need to make a stronger commitment to our employees in terms of their engagement and development as we look both in 20 and into the future. So with those sort of broader priorities, I did give the staff some parameters as they start to think through the budget in their development. One is just, again, we're going to reinforce that safety trumps service, and that will always be our mantra. And to be frank, one example of that is the platforms that we will be doing in late 19 budget. That is a safety issue. And, yes, it has service impacts, but we have to deal with the safety issues, and that's an example of that. I suggested to them that they do not look at service cuts nor fare increases. I'm asking them to come back with things that improve customer service to grow ridership, and we'll see what types of things that come out of that. Additional management efficiencies, again, we've done quite a bit over the last few years, but we need to continue to focus on that. A strong investment in employees of today and really for tomorrow, I think this is key. So we are doing quite a bit of efforts already, but we need to do more in that area. I want to make sure that they're looking at all the flexibilities that we have under federal funding regulations, that we're maximizing those opportunities where we can. Again, that we build the capacity to deliver the program. So it's one thing to get the dollars. It's another thing to deliver the program, make sure that we continue to create the resources internally to do that and the talent to do that. We continue and should continue to explore outsourcing where appropriate and allowed, but also where appropriate. And, of course, we have to meet the mandatory jurisdictional 3% subsidy cap. So that's sort of the marching orders that the staff is developing the capital operating program on. So it is still under development, and, again, the details will be coming in this fall, but I think it's important that we just get an overall overview of where we're heading with the capital and operating program. So I was going to turn it to Tom and Dennis to give a little bit more of that, if you could.
Thank you, Paul. So as the general manager just highlighted, a structured and actively managed capital program is critical for Metro to deliver on the priorities of safe and reliable service with infrastructure, equipment, and other assets in a state of good repair, all while managing the jurisdictional and federal investment in the system responsibly. Metro designed and is now building and implementing a structure for capital program development for new projects and ongoing reinvestment programs. New capital projects and programs start with capital planning activities, including asset management, condition assessments, inspections, capital needs inventories, and an organized capital needs prioritization process. In 2016, Metro completed a $25 billion capital needs inventory that informed the general manager's plan to keep Metro safe, reliable, and affordable, and is really the foundation for the capital program outlook for the next 10 years. Metro also recently completed an asset management plan for 2018 to 2022 that includes Metro's strategies and planned actions to improve asset management practices over the next 4 years. During the development phase of the capital program, capital needs are considered in Metro's development and evaluation program, which is effectively a program to turn needs, requirements, and problems into defined projects. After the development evaluation program, projects begin project development, where clear project scopes, schedules, cost estimates, budgets, implementation plans are further defined, and where the for a lot of projects where the procurement process begins. Projects and programs then move to active implementation. Major projects and safety reliability programs that are underway already include Metro's acquisition of new 7000 series rail cars, the radio and wireless systems upgrade project, the new Andrews Federal Center bus facility, and WMATA's office consolidation strategy, as well as all of Metro's ongoing reinvestment programs to ensure the safety, reliability, and state of good repair of vehicles, infrastructure, equipment, and other assets. Projects and reinvestment programs that are already underway and are currently in the procurement cycle to be in implementation by FY20 are expected to total about $1.3 billion for the FY20 year. Upcoming projects and programs in development and or in the procurement phase include Metro Station Platform Reconstruction Program and Station Improvement Program, which will begin in Virginia next summer. A new heavy maintenance and overhaul facility for rail cars, the replacement of Bladensburg and Northern bus garages with new modern facilities, and the new 8000 series rail car procurement. In the development and evaluation program, which is Metro's process for progressing, as I said, capital needs into defined capital projects, includes the development of a bridge and aerial structure rehabilitation program, bus and rail yard facility rehabilitation programs, concept planning and alternatives analysis for the blue-orange silver line capacity and reliability challenges, and the development of station improvement projects to address customer circulation, crowding, and access challenges at core stations and other key stations like Gallery Place. So the general manager's proposed six-year capital program and the FY20 capital budget will be based on these active projects, the projects in project development, and those in currently in the development evaluation program. And as the general manager said, we'll continue to provide additional information with the proposed budget and in the coming months. With that, I'll turn it over to Dennis for operating.
Thanks. Thank you, Tom. As the general manager indicated a few minutes ago, the FY 2020 operating The FY 2020 operating budget recommendation that this committee will receive next month will, in addition to prioritizing safety and compliance, also focus on three key areas. First, it will seek to rebuild ridership through better customer engagement. Second, it will take additional steps to improve operating efficiency, including additional non-fare revenue opportunities. And third, the budget will invest in Metro's employees to help customers, or rather to help customer improve customer service and increase employee accountability. A key driver for rebuilding Metro's ridership is service reliability, as well as better customer service. In FY 2020, Metro will seek to further leverage the rush hour promise, which credits customers for who experience a delay of 50 minutes or more during rush hours. Metro will also look at additional class options, including ones that may appeal more to visitors and occasional riders, as the agency looks for ways to also increase average bus service, given the increase in gridlock that we see on the streets. Finally, the FY budget recommendation will also evaluate Metro's hours of service as well as the frequency of service to see if there are ways to further optimize the service we provide to customers, along with additional investments in new ways for reaching our customers as well as non-riders to get them to try or to continue to use Metro service. With respect to employees, again, as the general manager indicated, we are going to help drive employee development accountability beginning with the 2020 budget. Obviously, the initiative will take more than a year to be fully implemented. But those initiatives will focus on recruitment, development, and engagement with Metro's employees to better serve Metro's riders. As the committee is aware, 70% of Metro's operating budget is for personnel. But Metro has historically not invested much in ensuring the right recruitment or development of its employees. So we are going to begin that journey with respect to the FY20 budget. Finally, improved relations with Metro's unions and better workplace for Metro's employees will help to build a workplace culture that is focused on customer service and accountability and enable Metro to meet its service and fiscal accountability goals. As the GM mentioned a little bit earlier, FY 2020 will be the first year under the new mandated operating subsidy growth cap that was recently enacted by the state of Maryland and the Commonwealth of Virginia. This means that Metro's operating subsidy for baseline services in FY 2020 can only grow by 23%. If the subsidy grows beyond that point or beyond that level, Metro will lose a lot of funding that currently comes from both states. A few exceptions, as you can see on this slide. There are things that have been excluded from the 3% calculation, which we call above the baseline. The first being services, equipment, and facilities required by law, rule, or regulation. And in this category, you can think like something like paratransit services or the new OSHA regulations that Metro has to comply with. The second category are capital projects approved by the board, in which case we think of the new civil line extension that we expect will be coming online soon. And then there's payment or obligations from or related to legal disputes or proceedings. Again, something like the CBA could fall under that particular category. As we look forward to FY 2020, if you use the laws enacted by the state of Maryland and the Commonwealth of Virginia as the baseline for determining 3%, what you see on this slide is a sense of what the subsidy level will be for FY 2020. Starting with, on the top level, the FY19 original subsidy, which was $1.9 billion. As you'll recall, the committee made an adjustment to add additional services, which increased that by $7 million. When you subtract the revenue that's generated by that service, that increased the subsidy requirement by $6 million. An additional adjustment of $45 million to the FY 2019 base subsidies reflected on this slide to accommodate the CBA and settlements for prior years that just occurred. So when you add all of that together, the updated subsidy level is $1.06 billion. And when you multiply that by 3%, you come to the $32 million, or a total subsidy of $1.092 billion for next year. This is the baseline subsidy expectation, and it is consistent with the laws, the dedicated funding legislation that the GM referred to a few minutes ago. What this slide shows is that when you compare the 3% mandated subsidy growth for 2020 to just inflation, it shows the challenge posed by the subsidy cap for the organization. But Metro, as the GM said a little bit earlier, also faces a revenue challenge, including potential revenue losses from major system reconstruction outages scheduled for next year, which all combined is expected to total $23 million. So just those two factors alone puts Metro behind the curve even before any customer engagement or employee recruitment and development investments, two key investments that are designed to help Metro improve customer service and regain ridership. As I said earlier, the GM's budget recommendation will anticipate that the Silver Line extension will begin revenue operations sometime in 2020. At least that's the current schedule that we have. So consistent with the dedicated funding legislation, the GM's budget recommendation will expect that the new Silver Line service, along with the incremental paratransit expenses and new hearing alcohol and drug testing requirements required by OSHA, will be above Metro's baseline subsidy requirements.
Right. So with that, it's just some general overview of the capital operating project. I just wanted to bring just some of the key policy issues that we need to discuss going forward with the board and for the board to consider. One is on the capital program, we had established a policy of reducing the amount of dollars that we were using, federal dollars, for the operating side that dealt with maintenance. We had set a goal of $30 million. I think that's something we should look at, given obviously the dedicated funding and the ability to use those dollars. Sure. We had, if you recall, a few years ago, there was a policy set where we were using some federal dollars on for operating maintenance, and it was into that program. It was the direction of the board that should be reduced to $30 million. And so we're at $60 million, I believe, last year. So we need to just revisit that. And part of it was where you were taking money away from capital to do the operating. But now we have this infusion of capital dollars. And also the reality is the maintenance, if you don't do the maintenance, it becomes capital projects. That's why the federal government allows you to use those dollars there. So I just think that's something that we need to discuss further, whether or not we maintain that policy or not and the implications that has on the budget. And then also for the operating budget, I think there needs to be a discussion of what's within and without the 3% cap. As we develop the budget, we need to have an understanding of the collective understanding of what is in and what is outside of the cap so that we can do that, whether it's the CBA, whether it's the additional loss of revenues with projects that we have to do to maintain the system to keep it safe, and the platforms is an example of that. The extra hours that we're using for preventive maintenance without action, those hours come back in July, so that obviously would have an implication on the operating budget, much less some of the other issues that we've been trying to do with from a safety and a maintenance standpoint. Again, we have no contingency fund to deal with other issues. One that's not here is the if we want to increase the additional funding for the OPEB trust, for instance. And so, again, those are numbers that we would have to build into the budget, so we'll need to have a discussion of that. And then these longer-term issues that are out there, again, they've been talked about before and will continue to be, but we do not want to lose focus on them. It's just the $200 million a year in the annual budget that is going towards pension and OPEB cost. At an earlier discussion with the audit, that is a growing number and will grow in the near term, particularly in the OPEB costs. And so those are things that, again, we feel that need to be addressed. The bus transformation project that's in the D&E program, it will not hit the 20 budget, but we know it's coming, and we have to address the overall issues around bus and how do we generate more revenue out of that and how do we provide that service efficiently. So these are not – I'm not looking for answers today, but I think it just frames out you both Tom and Dennis have framed out some of the things that we're wrestling with before we come back to you with a budget. But these are some of the larger policy issues, I think, for the board to start to consider. So with that, we'll hit on the schedule real quick. Just
right.
So, people are
so following today's discussions and direction from the committee, the general manager will submit his recommended budget to the board next month to be followed by additional deliberations by the committee and then public outreach and hearing on the proposed budget prior to coming back to the board for formal consideration. So with that, we conclude our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Dennis, Tom. So let me ask a question, and going back, because I think there's some confusion with what the 2019 actual number is before we talk about putting the 3% increase on top of that. And the 3% increase really is only the subsidy from the local jurisdictions, right? So it's not our actual budget, but I understand. So there was a one-time payment for past years in the collective bargaining agreement, and then there was $27 million that got put into 2019 salaries. Is that correct?
No. As you see on this slide, there's a $45 million that's included in the subsidy for to cover prior years, FY18 and FY19 primarily. The 27
that will be for this current year's
that's
subsidy.
Correct. That's correct.
Right.
The $27 million that you reference and that Paul alluded to with respect to the 3% going forward is the additional, the incremental cost for the CBA in FY2020. So those are two different numbers. But with respect to the subsidy itself, it is the $45 million as of today. The question that, which is a policy one that the GM raised, is how this committee or the board wishes to treat the additional, the incremental piece going forward, which is the $27 million.
Okay. So in staff's opinion, that 1060 number is the 19 base from which we will take a look.
That's correct.
Okay. Questions from other Corbett?
I'm going to be like Mike. I have a series of questions, but I may not be as.
Thank you. I was looking
for the word. I was looking for the word. Try long-winded. I have my own personal question. I have one from the jurisdiction which I represent. One of the questions I have is how are you proposing going about getting a rainy day fund? I mean,
could you repeat the question?
I said my question specifically is regarding the rainy day fund. How are you going to proceed with trying to fund a rainy day fund given all the challenges that we currently have? I'm in favor of it, but how would you go about formulating that? I'm sorry.
So the general manager's Kimsford proposal included the recommendation that the organization should have a rainy day fund to cover the extraordinary expenses that occur during the year, whether it's snow or special events. And the proposal at that time was that in addition to the annual subsidy, that the jurisdiction should consider, or that this board should consider, providing a 10% of the operating budget over a 10-year period as an additional contribution each year to create a rainy day fund, which would then help insulate the jurisdictions from having to go back to them when these occasional incidents occur. So our expectation remains that it needs to be funded as an additional provision to Metro to help create that particular fund.
And built up over time.
Sure. Thank you. That answers that one question. Regarding pension liability out there, I believe, and you can certainly correct me, that we're paying it from operations currently, correct, in terms of what, about $100 million, $200 million? How much are we paying on an annual basis?
$165
okay.
million. Okay. The pensions. The pension. And the OPEB is $45
okay.
million.
Those two items there that we're currently paying out of operations, is that exempt from the 3%?
We do not believe that the pension contributions are exempt from the 3%. The OPEB contributions, however, is a different issue. That would be paid by the trust if there was a trust established, which means that the annual operating cost for Metro will be $45 million less. The pension fund, the $165 million in contributions to pension, is the annual contributions actually determined. It is not exempt because obviously it's an ongoing cost, but the OPEB cost, the $45 million which we are paying on a pay-as-you-go basis, is certainly one that we should not be doing as an operating cost going forward.
The last question here, what is the approximate percent increase in a jurisdiction's subsidies for FY 2020? Does that include the $90 million in exempt cost increase?
For FY 2020, the baseline increase, as I've described today, will be 3%. The total increase will depend on the additional above-the-board services, right? If Silver Line comes in next year, that will certainly impact that. If it doesn't, then it's just a 3%. Obviously, there's a significant issue that we all know with respect to paratransit in terms of the cost, and that will be provided to the jurisdictions, but it will be above the baseline cost, which jurisdictions will be responsible for.
All right, my last comment is from a financial point of view. Those liabilities of the pension and OPEC is going to severely hamper our ability to operate going forward. And those liabilities are going to grow as we move forward. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think that at some point in time, we're going to have to turn to the jurisdictions to help begin to fund those liabilities. I mean, because we cannot operate with that onerous liability out there. So that concludes. That's an editorial comment, so there's no need to answer that. Thank you.
Thank you, Corbett. Other questions? Michael.
Sure. As a former chair of the committee, I have a lot of questions that occur to me when I review your documents, so I'll try and keep them within limitations right now. I do want to just follow up on the chair's questions on your slide having to do with the operating budget increase. It's the slide that says FY 2020 3% base subsidy growth level. Yeah. So as I think Mr. Corker was indicating, you've added the $6 million, which I totally agree with, because that represents what the committee last year voted as increases for improved service on the Red Line and improved bus service in the district and Virginia. The $45 million is one that I guess I have two kinds of concerns about that. You tried to respond to Mr. Corcoran about that, and I think what I heard you say is that the $45 million includes not just what you're projecting are the CBA settlement costs for FY 2020, but it also includes some 2019 catch-up money?
That's not accurate.
Okay. What does the $45 million represent? Because it's a different number than the $25 million that we voted on last month on the CBA settlement for FY19, and it's different than the $27 million that you have in some of your materials that go along with the slides. So what is the $45 million?
Actually, last month the board voted on $54 million.
Yeah, but that included both the FY18 numbers, and it also included the $15 million back pay catch-up.
Exactly.
Which I assume isn't, that we don't have to, not include it going forward.
No, the only number that's not in here is the back pay catch-up, because that doesn't accumulate. Right, that's taken out. Not the back pay catch-up, rather, but the vacation payout.
The vacation
is not included in here. But we have These numbers reflect FY18 and FY19 costs, most of which has already been paid out, some of which are assumed given the settlements that we already have. But it does not include FY20. What's included in FY20, as I responded to Mr. Cochran, is the $27 million of incremental CBA costs projected for FY20. They are not in these numbers, but they were in the numbers that the general manager described as policy issues that this committee needs to opine on with respect to whether or not they're in or out of the 3%.
All right, so this 45 number is includes something other than just what the FY 2019 compensation cost is for the CBA settlement, plus some increase.
That's no, what I'm trying it, to get.
What else is in there besides just FY19 compensation costs projected forward for 1 year?
Okay. It includes FY18 and FY19. There's no forward projections included in those numbers.
All right. So I guess the question becomes, and it is a policy question, whether FY18 should be included in that number as part of the base, since that represents a period, other than FY19. A base should be what are the costs of operation in FY19 in the current year.
Okay.
And you've sort of put in there another chunk of money from FY18, correct?
The reason why that's in there, as we've described to you and the committee last month, is because, as we told the jurisdictions over the last 3 years, we did not include those baseline expected costs. But we did not include them in the budget because we wanted to protect the jurisdictions from the arbitration process, assuming that those funds are there and therefore are making those awards. If we had done that, the numbers that you're looking at would have suddenly been higher. But those costs are real, and the jurisdictions all understand that those are real costs, which are part of the base and therefore part of the cost that will be paid in FY20.
I hear your arguments, and I think it'll be something that board members as well as jurisdictions will have to think about and may have some questions on whether that's a number that's properly, the FY18 numbers are properly included in that number to compute what is the base.
So, Mike, if I may,
forward.
So everybody's in agreement that the 2019 increases mandated by the CBA agreement are included. What was that number?
That's 45 million dollars.
Right? 25.1.
18 and 19 are 45 million dollars.
Right, 18 yeah, and
18
19.
18 is 7.8 million. FY19 is 25.1.
However, the 2018 number has to be included for 18 and for 19. Because that number, while it was a catch-up, it still does go into current salaries.
That's correct.
Or compensation.
That's correct.
Right? Which was not included in there. So that is in the 19. So the 19 is the cumulative of the increase for 19 as well as that mandated increase for 18. So it's all in there now. So the 45 million, it was not just, while it was a one-time payment, it was a catch-up payment to be included into the current compensation model as well.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I understand what Dennis is saying. We'll just have to see whether there's consensus among the jurisdictions that that's the correct way to interpret the legislative cap.
All right. Other questions from committee members? You did say you were going to go quick.
I am going to go, but there are 2 points I want to make. So the total, just so we're clear, the total increase for the jurisdictions for FY2020 now is the sum of the 45 plus the 32, or 77 million, over what they've actually paid under the FY19 budget that we approved last year?
That is correct with respect to baseline services.
I just want to, I guess the point I want to make as we go forward, both to general managers who produce a budget and my board members, is at least from Maryland's point of view, this is going to be a big hit because you're essentially saying that for FY 2020, the operating budget request will be about 25 to 30 million to Maryland, on top of the 167 million that was agreed to by the legislature last year as part of the FY dedicated funding. So that's about 200 million. And I guess I just need to say up front that to present something that asks more than that is going to be in the World War II promise, wording maybe a bridge too far, and I just caution you as you shape the budget, the operating budget over the next month, you know, as to what is really capable for the jurisdictions to be asked to produce in terms of both combined operating budget and capital budget for FY 2020. I'll stop there, and I do have one more question. I do want to turn, because I promised Tom I'd ask him a capital budget question. So the capital...
Does that mean you're asking the question now?
I am.
Okay.
As I came today, I noticed that the Red Line trains are extremely crowded. It's reminiscent of the last time I was in Tokyo or Shanghai in terms of the crowding and rush hour between 8 and 9. And I think a lot of that is because at rush hour, there's still a mix of both 8-car and 6-car trains at rush hour on the Red Line. And so I assume that that's because you need the power upgrades in order to permit all 8-car train service in rush hour. And I just want to ask on your chart, which shows some of the projects underway. It's the one entitled Major Projects and Safety and Reliability Programs Underway. You indicate under rail power systems, and I just want to confirm with you that an upgrade, power upgrade on the Red Line is included in that 2025 CIP that you say is programs that are already in the capital improvement budget.
Yes, the Red Line power upgrade program that's been in the program for some time is included. That is one element of power upgrades are one element of what's required to run higher capacity, more frequent service. Yeah.
And what is the when will that part of the project be completed?
So the full implementation of the Red Line is currently scheduled for around 2025.
2025. Yes. Now, is that because there are no funds for it in 2020 and 2021? Is it just phased so that it starts later in the five-year cycle? Or is it because it's a five-year project?
It's the project is phased over time, so the across the lines of the system, and so the current schedule has the Red Line starting relatively soon and then completing in 2025.
Now, if we board decides that they want to move that along, expedite it, is that possible to put more money in 20 and 21 to get a earlier finish date so that increased 8-car trains could be operated on the Red Line?
So money is just one of the considerations here. We would also have to consider the sequence of projects, the impact to service, to do the power upgrades, but certainly we could look at that.
I appreciate it if you would. The overcrowding is really bad at rush hour. I was really surprised. And notice that's been a consistent problem, even over the summer, that between 8 and 9, the overcrowding of Red Line trains is really... it's not a service option that's going to encourage people to be come back to be riders.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Steve.
Yes, first of all, I want to compliment the gentleman managing the staff. I think the guidelines here represent absolutely the correct priorities that, first and foremost, we do need to continue making the necessary investments in the safety and reliability of the system. If we don't make those investments, we won't have a transit system. And it's important that... all of us, including the public, be aware that we're not simply making the necessary investments for the coming year. We are making up for years of underinvestment or failure to execute. And that's going to have an impact on our operations for some time. Hopefully not very long, but we're not out of the woods yet from my understanding. And people need to understand that. If we don't stay with that program, we're just heading right back to the bad old days and the problems we ran into. Particularly interested in the efforts to develop the capital investment pipeline and all that's encompassed in that in that brief statement, and I would like this committee to hear more about that at a future date, what progress we're making towards, you know, professionalizing, making more scientific exactly what we're putting into the pipeline there. And then on the operations side, again, you know, a goal of operating in the most efficient way possible so that we can maximize and target service, but within available subsidy. We've got a constraint here. This is not a business where every new customer represents more profit for the organization. It's the opposite. And I'm glad that we are looking for creative ways to chase new revenue through the use regs, for example, looking through joint development opportunities to get another marginal passenger on the trains we're already running so that we're not incurring additional operating costs. But it would be crazy for this authority to simply run more trains in off-peak times chasing additional passengers. That's going to add to the subsidy that's required for the jurisdictions, and the jurisdictions have made clear they want to see a 3% cap on that growth, and we have to recognize it's a binding constraint and not extend the yellow line down to my driveway and have a 7,000 series rail car at my beck and call. I would ride that every day, multiple times a day, but it's not worth it. So thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Clarence.
I think there are a couple of things. One, it looks like we're going to be possibly going back to the jurisdictions for additional funds in 20 or 21 or whatever. And I think one of the things that we really need to make sure is that the numbers and that the dollar, that the budget is transparent. I think when you start asking for more money over the capital improvement and the operating, more questions become around spending and what is the number. And I think where you've made great progress from what I can see, but the conversation needs to move from the number to the policy. So we probably need to look at some ideas around how we can make the numbers more transparent so that we agree on the number. We just got to figure out what we're going to do. And then also on the long-term pension and other related long-term costs, that's something we need to look at and begin to address and be able to articulate, because this is going to squeeze out. This will probably grow faster than 3%, I guess. Yeah, so this is an uncontrollable cost right now. It's going to grow faster than 3%. It's going to squeeze out safety and operations over the long haul. So trying to get our arms around that and begin to frame some alternative solutions or ways that we're going to try to cap it or whatever the case may be is something that I believe we need to look at this year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other comments? Christian.
So a question, Mr. Chairman. What is the process going to be for consideration of the 2020 budget? Have you outlined or designed how you expect everyone will be included in terms of soliciting questions, clarifying things with staff, and deliberating over the budget?
So beginning next month, we will actually receive a proposed budget, and we will have opportunities to look into each thing, maybe not exactly how we did it last year, but similar to last year, so that all committee, all board members will have an opportunity to weigh in. All jurisdictions will have that opportunity.
Yeah, I'd encourage you to do something like that. You know, the current process that we have for consideration of or inclusion of non-committee members on discussions probably will not work for the budget. Just to point out to you something that I know you're acutely aware of, a significant number of the contributors to the operating budget in Virginia are not reflected on the Finance Committee, and that in and of itself is not a problem, but with the budget, it's important.
Certainly within Virginia, you and I can take that offline with the other jurisdictions.
Yes.
Okay. Jack, you had something?
Yes, thank you. And again, thank you for the presentation. Are we sharing, and this would be for both Paul and Dennis, all this information with the CFOs in the region from the various jurisdictions?
Yes. Okay. I'm, We have a conference call with the CFOs on a quarterly basis, and I share all of this. I walked them through the settlements, and obviously I share the outlook with them.
Because that will be critical, certainly from the district's point of view, that Jeff DeWitt is completely apprised of what we're looking at here, because and I'm sure the other members have this when they go to their jurisdictions. It gets really in the weeds on this 3%, this, that, and the other thing. So what people will be asking me is, what's the number? Not the various different ways we slice and dice it. And, you know, my numbers and our staff numbers look like we're looking at a 12% increase over last year when you put it all together. And so it's just very important from my point of view that my CFO understands this as quickly as possible. So as we are putting together our budget in the district starting in November as well for our delivery to the council in March, that all of this information is encompassed in those numbers that we'll be voting on over there as well. So it's just to stress that, and I know that you have met with the CEO. I think the whole dedicated funding was achieved for many reasons, but one of them was the constant interaction between yourself and the CFOs in the region, so they knew what was going on.
That's correct.
And are able to convey to their leadership, better than the board members do, why we need this money and where it's going to come from. So that's critical. I will be the third or fourth or fifth voice to talk about the pensions and the other post-employment benefits. There is, as I said at the earlier meeting, when we met with our auditors today, and under new auditing standards, these liabilities are now pushed to the forefront where they never were before. We have a $2.5 billion liability sitting out there that is not uncommon, but it still, for us, is a huge number, and we need to begin to address this. The jurisdictions are not going to want to address it. Across the country, nobody wants to address it. The idea of we'll just pay as we go and somehow we'll muddle through is not something I aspire to, but many people do. So we just have to keep this out there. I mean, Clarence, you said we cannot not address this, although there will be enormous pressure not to address this. We have other pressing needs today, so why can't we put this off till tomorrow? Well, starting, I think it was 2010, in this organization, there was an idea of trying to fund this. Now it's 8 years later or whatever it is, and we have, what, $3 million in the fund, Paul, or something ridiculous like that? So I just, you know, I'm almost piling on, keep saying, particularly on the other post-employment benefits, that number is going to grow, and it's going to hit us real fast. Like next year, not so bad, the year after, not so bad, and then all of a sudden it'll be there, and it'll be enormous. And if we don't begin to address it now, future board members will wonder why we didn't. So just want to stress that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. May I ask a technical question, too? And it refers around Silver Line Phase 2 and when that's coming on board. And when does Loudoun County start to participate in the operating budget subsidies?
As soon as the Silver Line starts operations, which we expect will be in 2020.
In calendar year 2020?
Fiscal year 2020.
Okay. So so day one, they start writing a check. Okay.
That's correct.
Not day one minus one.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
Can I just follow up briefly on that? But we'll be encouraging... So we'll be incurring costs before the Silver Line commences operations. How are those going to be treated?
That's what you just whispered to me. That's accurate. You know, we'll start recruiting and training law enforcement personnel who will start doing that. The conversations with Loudoun obviously is not final yet. The expectation is that they will start paying with respect to the operating cost. So whenever the operating cost starts is when they will. That is expected to be about 6 months before revenue service.
So when the costs start, not when the trains start.
That's correct.
Thanks. Okay. Okay. Any other comments? All right. Thank you. With that, the committee's business is finished, and we adjourn. I turn it over to you, Mr. Evans.